people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a part of God's deed. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fog that I keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. You running down my country, man. You walking on the fight beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio .com. Well, this is Paul Fong. Oh, well, we're going to have to stop Merle here for a minute. This is Paul Fong, and you're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio .com. Here's an interesting story from Australia. Dealing with minorities. Sydney suburb bans construction of a synagogue over fears it could be a terrorist target. Locals in Bondi, and that's a beach area near Sydney, were worried about the space would pose a security risk to nearby residents and chose to reject the proposal, a decision that's infuriated religious, well, let's say Jewish leaders. But of course, I guess maybe they're the only ones who are important. The temple was to be built in Bondi, a short walk from Australia's famous Bondi Beach. But locals worried that the space would pose a security risk to nearby residents, motorists, and pedestrians. As evidence of that threat, the council pointed to the synagogue's own design, which included setback buildings and blast walls. They also said the design would have an unacceptable impact on the street in the neighborhood. A number of residents agreed with the contentions and provided additional evidence against the development of the site, the council said in a statement. Friends of refugees from Eastern Europe, I wonder if those include Christians, a Jewish group, immediately appealed that decision to the Land and Environmental Court. This is in Sydney, Australia. The protective design, the group said, was not a commentary on the risk the temple faced, but rather a best practice used at lots of synagogues. It also offered to do a redesign, but the court sided with the council. In its decision, the court explained that Western countries are under threat from ISIS, and that the potential of an attack in Australia is considered probable by government officials. In other words, it's not a matter of when, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. The court also noted that the designs would serve only to protect those inside the building. Yep, well, of course. Typically selfish. Although there are about 120,000 Jews in Australia, they have an awful lot of power, though, including 50,000 in the Sydney area. An undercurrent of anti-Semitism runs through the country. Oh, yeah, everybody hates them. Well, maybe one of the reasons, and of course that's exaggerated, everybody doesn't hate the Jews, but one of the reasons is, and I know personally know victims of the Jewish censors in Australia, people like my friend historian Frederick Tobin and fellow teacher, people like the late Eric Butler, the late Philip Butler, his son, the Jews there, as in other Western countries, throw their weight around, try to get pet politicians to pass anti-free speech laws. Yeah, there are people who don't like that, and rightly so. You want to take away my freedom? I like you too much. But of course, yeah, this never gets in the way of a good old boo-hoo-hoo. The announcement came just days after Australian authorities failed a major terror plot to blow up an airplane using an explosive, a homemade explosive device, and to reload poison release poison gas. But it may reflect something uglier too. Although there are about 120,000 Jews in Australia, including 50,000 in the Sydney area, an undercurrent of anti-Semitism runs through the country. Attacks on Jews and Jewish property jumped 10% in 2016. Jewish community groups logged a total of 210 incidents that included physical assaults and harassment, along with vandalism and graffiti. In one instance, a 22-year-old was punched in the neck and called an expletive as he walked home from synagogue. In another, onlookers threw eggs at Jews as they walked home from Friday night synagogue services. The problem with a list like that, you've got to read it carefully. The whole country, according to the Jews themselves, there were 210 incidents. Well, that's not a lot, you know. That included physical assaults and harassment, along with vandalism and graffiti. Okay. No murders, no bombings, physical assaults. Well, it seems that the best one they've got is a 22-year-old was punched in the neck and called an expletive. Okay. Well, of course, we're not even privileged to know what the expletive was. He might have annoyed somebody's boyfriend. It could be entirely a personal matter, you know. But I would say if that's the one assault in the whole of the years, there's not exactly a wave of anti-Semitism. When I know the Australian political situation pretty closely, and the major parties are firmly subservient to Israel, to the Zionists, and are great backers of Israel. So this is the standard boo-hoo-hoo. And among the other 210 incidents, there's harassment. Well, what might that be? And vandalism and graffiti. That doesn't mean necessarily graffiti on a Jewish synagogue. For instance, in Canada, the League for Human Rights of B'nai B'rith publishes and has for at least a quarter of a century an annual audit of anti-Semitic incidents. And every year you can predict it. It gets worse and worse. This year was worse than last, and last was worse than the year before. You would think the black shirts were back in town. In fact, it's almost all hooey. Because you know what constitutes an anti-Semitic incident? Well, somebody reports a leaflet that they consider anti-Semitic. Now, or a hate crime. I have a bumper sticker that says "No more wars for Israel." If I were to take my bumper sticker and put it on a construction hoarding, and some narrow-minded Jew were to see it and call it into B'nai B'rith, that would be an incident. What is it? It's a bumper sticker. "No more wars for Israel." Is that anti-Semitic? It's all in the eye of the beholder. There are Jews who don't want any more wars in the Middle East. So, that one then, of course, pamphlets. A pamphlet that mentions Jews in a negative way would be, by B'nai B'rith standards, an anti-Semitic incident. Well, supposing an ambitious group hands out 1,000 in an area where there are a lot of Jews, and suppose 50 people call them in. Well, about 50 incidents. Oh my gosh, it just gets worse and worse, doesn't it? What you have to do is to read very carefully, sit very carefully through the report to find out, well, what are the serious things? Bombings, arson, serious vandalism, murder, serious assault. And when you shake it all out, almost nothing. Hello? Hello? Yeah, can we do it in about 3/4 of an hour? Okay, great, thanks. So, almost nothing, which is about what you'd expect from a country whose leadership, almost to an individual, is 110% pro-Israel, let's say. Or in the case of the former conservatives, Israel first. This is one big old act. Holocaust denial pamphlets were distributed at several universities, along with neo-Nazi brochures. Well, Holocaust denial. Questioning another tribe's tribal history, which concerns me, not the leaflets, concerns me because that tribal history is in the process of being imposed on us. Jews, as far as I'm concerned, can believe anything they want about themselves. I only have a problem when I am supposed to subscribe to it, which is what the new religion of Holocaust is. It is essentially a religion for you and me. It is not a religion for the Jews. Well, it is in a sense. It's their tribal history. But unlike other tribal histories, which we are not, which most of us know very little about, and are certainly under no pressure to adopt, that is the mischievous problem of the new religion of Holocaust. It's something imposed upon us. For the purposes, of keeping whites guilty, giving Israel a special pass, because after all, they're special because of the Holocaust, not seeing our own interests, because it will always be brought up to us, if you're opposed to immigration, you want another Holocaust. Not that there's much of a connection, but that's the sort of thing. And of course, a guilty population, or at least a guilty leadership, is one that is not likely to make good decision in the interest of our group. Anyway, so those are among the other incidents. Two vehicles were firebombed, the glass door of a synagogue was broken, and graffiti artists covered the walls of synagogues with messages like fucking Jew and the Yuva. I'm not sure even what that means. All right, those are incidents of vandalism, yes. Not good, but in a nation of 25 million people, if this is the worst you can point to, you've got to say, not much to cry about. Anyway, that never stopped groups that have thrived off being victims. Okay, so kind of an interesting story there out of Australia. Donald Trump's new legislative proposals on immigration. In fact, it's been called the biggest immigration change, the biggest immigration reform since 1965. Then was the catastrophic 1965 Immigration Act, which. By which the United States threw open the doors to the Third World, turned its back on its traditional sources of immigration, which were basically Europe and the British Isles, and began the Third World replacement of the European family settler people that we see today. And in fact, the United States is now only 61% white, and will, unless something is done, be... whites will be a minority by the by 2041. Well, if passed, I think it's important to emphasize if, because there will be powerful forces ranged against it. However, proposals are quite good. For instance, for one thing, there will be a 50% reduction in immigration. That's illegal immigration. That in itself is a huge plus. That will buy at least some time. Secondly, and Donald Trump is pitching this as having to do with improving American job prospects. Good. That's a good thing, because the immigration has had the effect of keeping Americans unemployed and keeping wages low. Why? Because with a fairly high unemployment and more bodies coming, there are fewer reasons for many employers to raise wages. Why? Well, if you don't want to work, well, we can get somebody else to do the same job. Or even if you want to work, we can get somebody to do that job cheaper. So out you go. American workers are not well treated, nor are Canadians in many cases. So the reduction in numbers is huge. Then there are going to be new criteria. Criteria are that you're going to have to be qualified. There's going to be a competition. It isn't just show up there with your carcass and in you come. No, you've got to be qualified. For instance, you have to speak English. Well, there is the most unholy howl about that. Oh, in fact, one commentator was so stupid. One reporter was so stupid as to challenge a White House spokesman by saying, "Well, then only people from Australia and England can get in." I guess this guy is linguistically challenged, doesn't even know that, well, Canadians speak English. Even a lot, fair number of people from the third world speak English, and many Europeans speak English. Is this an unreasonable requirement? Not at all. How are you going to do well in the job market? And how are you going to make a contribution if you can't speak English? It's not as things were 100 years ago. Where yes, you could come, maybe you don't speak English, but somebody can, your boss can hand you a shovel, make a few shovel-like motions, and a pick, make a few whacks with the pick, and show you, okay, you're required to dig a hole here. Okay, you may not need English to do that. But, so, and beyond that, though, you'll have to have necessary job skills. Now, of course, the devil is going to be in the details. Not just a job skill, but a needed job skill. And there's a difference. Hypothetically, you may be a skilled worm picker, but perhaps America doesn't need any more worm pickers. So these are sensible criteria, which would reduce the number of immigrants, then that will help protect American labor, and will attract people. Will only admit people who have the language and the job skills that will give them a fighting chance to make a contribution rather than simply to be parasites. And even better, or best of all, Trump is going to limit the annual intake of so-called refugees because they're not screened normally for what they can do for America, but are screened only as to for security and as to whether or not they, in some way, shape, or form, are refugees. So all of this is, in my opinion, really good steps in absolutely in the right direction. Needless to say, it's come under considerable attack, even from some Republicans, including the junior senator from Arizona, whose name is, and I kid you not, Flake. Well, he certainly lives up to his name of Flake. He doesn't like these changes, doesn't like the new proposals, and is against proposals that would impose a language restriction, and so on. And of course, he comes up with the, we need immigration for our economy, the economy will fail. Of course, another argument in the States, as in Canada, is the old, we need immigration to grow the economy. Or no, there's going to be a job shortage. Okay. And Jamie Kelso and I talked about this on the American Freedom Party show earlier today. That's Sunday, and it's on every Sunday on Republic Broadcasting at between 3 and 6, and that's Eastern Standard Time. And we talked about this. I think it's a form of blackmail, actually. It's the sort of argument that's supposed to make a person who doesn't like this immigration say, well, okay, no, I don't like it, but, okay, otherwise there'll be a job shortage. Okay, first of all, as long as you've got unemployment, you don't have a job shortage. I'm sorry, a labor shortage. You're not going to have a labor shortage. Okay, so that's bogus, and it's still considerable unemployment in the United States. If you have something close to full employment, oh no, what are we going to do? Well, let me think. First of all, the labor market is somewhat fluid. At any given time, there are people who have given up looking for work, so they don't actually appear on the unemployment rolls. There are people who could work, like retired people, who would work with the right incentives. And housewives who might work, they might stay at home wives, but might work, say, part-time with the right incentives. So, what do you do? Well, maybe what one thing to do... Hello? Yeah? Oh, I'm doing my show. I'll call you right back. Well, one thing you can do is offer more money. You know, that used to be what the... supply and demand system required, and that's right. Supply and demand. If there is more of a demand for labor than there is supply, well, you increase the wages. When there's lots of supply and less demand, well, wages become static or even fall. That's the way the free market works. Well, what immigration has done is it short-circuits the free market. If you keep up an endless large supply, larger than the demand, well, then you've got static or falling wages. That's a good idea. The labor shortage argument turns out to be bogus on that and actually other grounds. And one of the other grounds is this. Okay, at some point you need you have not enough labor to fill the jobs at hand. Okay, well, one thing to do would be to offer higher wages, or as they're doing in Japan these days, you innovate. Like what? Well, how do you care for the elderly? The traditional method would be, well, several traditional methods, but one would be to have some sort of a living or a human help. All right, well, when you have not a lot of people interested in those in what would be low paying jobs, what do you do? Well, one thing you could do is you offer more money, and that's a possibility. Another thing is you robotize, and they're finding they're developing robots in Japan that are amazing at the work they can do, even bathing people and many other things. So the point is, we're intelligent people. And sometimes cheap labor is a lazy, easy way out. But innovations allow you to overcome the fact that you may not have enough hands to do jobs the way they were done traditionally. For instance, 100 years ago in middle-class homes in America and Canada, upper-middle-class homes, of course, the homes are very wealthy, all these tedious household chores, polishing the floor by hand, you know, waxing it by hand and polishing it, dishes for the whole family, washing them, drying them, clothing in a very primitive washing machine, or maybe just in a wash tub with a paddle to beat them. Then they had to be laboriously wrung out either by hand or by a hand wringer, and then hung up on the line, and then brought in most cases in the days before clothing that didn't all require ironing, then laboriously ironed. The household chores in many middle and upper middle class homes and the homes of the rich were done by maids, and the house of the homes of the rich by servants. Well, what happened? Well, you know what happened. You look around your own home or apartment. If you do have a floor that needs polishing, you've got an electric polisher. If you, in most places, the dishes are done by a dishwasher. No, not you. The machine. Your laundry, done in a washing machine. The drying, done in a dryer. Now, I know some people put the drying out of the laundry out to dry, basically through preference, but how are things done? We've used technology to replace all sorts of jobs that were there 100 years ago, or in some cases, I would say maybe only 50 or 60 years ago. So the point is that if there are not enough hands to do the job the way it's currently laid out, well, there are ways around that. Innovate. Wow. Innovate, yes. And what Trump's reforms are going to do, here's the big problem. If they're passed, what they're going to do is they're going to make the job market the awful lot better for American workers. The wages should be higher, they should be much closer to full employment, and at least some of the massive third world invasion will have been brought to a halt. And all that's to the good. I'm going to start taking a short musical interlude right now because I'm going to spend the latter half of the program on kind of some sad news, and this is the death of Ernst Zundel, a great historical revisionist publisher, and so on. And that will be the second half of the program, and we're going to start off with a kind of a bitter song from no, we're not. We're going to. This is a song with Merle Haggard and Gretchen Wilson. Gretchen's a lady with a very opinionated attitude, kind of a working class girl. This is a song with Merle Haggard called
I tried to the grocery store.
Politically Incorrect.
It's a family farm that's been in the family for over 100 years being sold.
They're concerned about the violence and the death.
Seems like I have, you know, less money to spend on
another deadly day in Iraq as 11 U.S. soldiers.
It's a free country.
I'm for the low man on the totem pole.
Thank you.
half the world already knows where I stand. Nothing wrong with the flag.
Nothing wrong with the working man. Me and no head. We're just so many. Can't get no respect.
None.
Politically incorrect.
For England's cause, far away from old Belfast. It was in the dark, uncertain days of early World War I, when England's shores were threatened by the jackboot of the Hun. When England's cry for help was heard, we bid her not no fear. For across the Flanders fields we will send our Ulster volunteers. It was on a place they call the Somme on the first day of July, when 20,000 Ulster men prepared to fight and die. Sure they bravely charged through no man's land with the raid and flying high. With the cry of no surrender voice, all those stirs battle cries. Now there's Germans in their trenches deep, good scares believe they rise. When up and charge those Ulster men and hear their battle cries. What kind of men are those, they said, who would leave their native land just to die upon this battlefield? And what is that strange red hand? On and on they fought that day, where others feared to tread. And on the wire and in the mud, they left behind their dead. But the only flag to fly that day behind those German lines was the old red hand of Ulster, with the shamrocks round her nine. Now those who lived came home again, what changes did they all find? For the countries that made Ulster up no longer numbered nine. Three counties had been sold away by those they fought to save. Yes, this was England's gratitude for the sacrifice they made. So gather round, my comrades, on this first of July morn, when Ulster men are rightly proud of a land where they were born. For they'll never more be led away to fight in foreign land, or to die for someone else's cause at an English man's command, or die for someone else's cause at an English man's command.
And that's kind of a bitter song from Ulster, An Englishman's Command. Going to have one more song here on this musical interlude, and this is called Bury Me. Well, this was going to be called Bury Me Under the... Yes, it is. It is Bury Me Under the Red Hand. That's the Red Hand of the Ulster Rebels. I should say, the Ulster Loyalists. And that's an Ulster Loyalist song, Bury Me Under the Red Hand. Well, sad news today. Learned this morning that Ernst Sundel passed away yesterday. And Ernst was a historical, a giant in the historical revisionist movement in the whole world. Ernst died at age 78 in the Black Forest, which is the area in which he grew up, in a home that had belonged to his family for over 500 years, and that he renovated. He died of a heart attack. His sister was with him, and apparently he did not suffer. Ernst Sundel, as I say, was a towering figure in the revisionist movement. And he went through quite a metamorphosis or development. Ernst was 19 when he emigrated to Canada in 1958. He came with the skills of a graphic artist. He went first to Montreal and then came on afterwards to Toronto. And he became very successful. He built a highly successful graphic arts business and did the advertising or graphic arts for many of the big businesses in Toronto, including the old Sears catalog. So he did well. He made a lot of money. He was a real success. When he was in Montreal, though, he began to change his political views. He said that up until then he had fairly conventional lefty liberal post-World War II views. Thought Germany was the going propaganda was that Germany was the bad one, the villain was at fault. But when he was in Montreal, Ernst Sundel met a very important man then in the latter years of his life. This man's name was Adrien Arcand. Arcand was a French-Canadian nationalist, and he spent time in prison during the Second World War because he had been the head of a pro-Mussolini fascist party. Adrien Arcand was a very educated man, a very dynamic speaker. But when the war was over, he fell on somewhat hard times. There were still sympathizers in the Quebec establishment who found him some jobs. But when Ernst knew him, he was in his latter years, and Ernst will say, Arcand taught me what it was to be a German. He taught me how to be a German. In other words, he gave him an ideological education about the role of the malign role that organized Jews have played in the West here, in much of the West, of the role of big finance, and also the meaning of nationalism and white nationalism. Ernst then moved on to Toronto, thinking about these things, began to do more reading, and then in the late 1970s, mid-70s, with the invention of this new religion of Holocaust. Remember, there was the Holocaust TV series. And suddenly, what had been a disorganized series of fanciful stories about the persecution, alleged persecution of Jews in World War II, now became more solidified as what I call the new religion of Holocaust. And whereas before there'd been some horror stories like things like Ilsa the SS and lampshades made out of human skin of Jews, and not true. That was actually a story that went back to the First World War, and that version didn't involve Jews. Shrunken skulls, the sort of stuff that used to appear in men's magazines like Saga. But by the mid-1970s, it became a lot more solidified. And it solidified around a number of things. The number six million Jews allegedly died during the Second World War. the fact that they were, many were, most were exterminated by in gas chambers and then cremated in crematoria in places particularly like Auschwitz, and in Auschwitz allegedly 4 million people were killed, of which 70% or roughly 2.8 million were Jews. This was the greatest crime in all of human history, and so on. And this became strongly repeated through the Hollywood, which is of course heavily controlled by Jews, and this got out there in the general public. Schools began teaching it, and what in a sense triggered Ernst Zundel into action was this. Germans of his own generation, who at this point had children in the school system, would come to him and say, well, they looked to him as a success story and a communicator, and said, well, look, Ernst, our kids are coming home, the teacher, and teachers can be real goofs, said, the Germans exterminated the Jews, or the Germans killed 6 million Jews. Well, you know, in a grade 2 class, little Heidi knows she's German, and other kids are mocking her, and so on. The teachers probably not had the sophistication to even to say the government did, not the people, but, you know, it's broad. You know, some teachers are disgraced, to say nothing of the fact that much of the media fell into this. Another huge round of German bashing. Yeah, good song, but not the one I want to play. Anyway, and so Ernst formed the Committee of Parents of German Descent. And they would go to schools and school boards and movie theaters that were playing anti-German movies, and notoriously German-bashing newspaper, the Toronto Sun in Toronto, and pick up them, and try to get another point of view across. After a couple of years, though, Ernst came to the conclusion that nothing effective could be done until this Holocaust thing was attacked. You see, if you were a group of, let's say, hypothetically, Albanian parents, and a teacher had said something very negative consistently about Albanians, well, school boards would be sympathetic to you, to the parents, and say, well, yes, that's not right to blame all, you know, Albanians for this or that, and to make your kids feel badly. And so something would be done. Perhaps the teacher would be reprimanded, or at least told to put things differently, or whatever. But as Ernst often said about the rules regarding him, there's one rule for everybody else, and there's a special rule, a harsher rule for Ernst. Same thing here. Another rule, a harsher rule for Germans. And what it came back down to was the so-called Holocaust. That was the 2,000 pound ugly elephant in the room. Germans deserve to be treated badly because of the Holocaust. So Ernst had already heard that there were considerable dissension about the so-called Holocaust. Whether it had happened in the way we're told. One of the very first critics of it was a Frenchman, a French leftist, named Paul Racine. And Racine had been in Auschwitz. And he was a man of the left, but he was in Auschwitz not because he was a Jew, because he wasn't a Jew. But he was in Auschwitz for politics and so on. And he didn't die in Auschwitz. And he said, well, a lot of what's being said about Auschwitz wasn't true. And I know I was there. And there were others. Now, Ernst was not an original researcher. But Ernst began to compile material. And one of the best and most famous, some would say most notorious, things was a lengthy pamphlet. Usually published in a format somewhat like the old... Time magazine, and my memory serves about 32 pages in length, with a nice cover, and it was called "Did 6 Million Really Die?" And it made a number of arguments that against the six million story. And you know, one might say superficially, "Well, what does it matter? All deaths are. Why are we quibbling over numbers?" Well, that would be true if the numbers were not so important. And if you did dissent, the Holocaust lobby did not say, "Well, thank you." Hello? Yes, can I call you back in a few minutes? I'm just doing my show. The Holocaust lobby did not say, that's good. We thought 6 million had died, but you point out there was only 250,000. It was bad, but not as bad as we feared. No. They wanted every single body to be counted. They wanted, and there's something bizarre about that. Honest people would say, "Well, that's good. I mean, the disaster was not as bad as we feared." But that's not the way it worked out, because of course the Holocaust was not a so much as historical account as it was a propaganda means to first of all bully the German people and keep their spirit, break their spirit, and also increasingly it wasn't just about Germans. All of the West, well, we're told we're all guilty. Even though it made no sense, those countries like Canada, the United States, and Britain that fought against National Socialist Germany, it really had become, although it would take some time before people like Ernst and others and myself saw it as such, it had become a religion with the irrationality of a religion. I don't mean to knock anybody's religion, but religion ultimately is a matter of belief. It's you can't reason to the tenets of a religion. They're laid out, and you believe or you don't believe. Well, it had become it was a religion, and the book Did 6 Million, or the pamphlet Did 6 Million Really Die, was really quite important because. It poked some major holes in the story, and with the idea that if this is false, then maybe much of the rest of it is false. And we are being, Germans are being unfairly blamed for something that wasn't what we were told. Well, then, why don't we stick to the facts? And as time went on and other historians got involved, there was no doubt that Jews were murdered in World War II. There's no doubt that there were some, what you might call, extrajudicial killings on the Eastern Front of Jewish collaborators who had involved themselves in the torture and abuse of people in the Baltic states and in the Ukraine, were sometimes summarily taken out either by locals or by the Germans and shot. Okay, so nobody's denying that Jews died. But what the whole Holocaust religion had become a club with which to be Germans, but with also with which, as increasingly our establishment or our elite in much of Canada, in much of the West, became devotees of this religion, it became a religion to keep us guilty. And if you're guilty, well then, if you say, well, I think we should keep, I don't want massive third world immigration to replace us. Oh well, you must be a Nazi. You don't believe in equality. You're the type of person who would commit a Holocaust. Now, none of that stuff makes any sense, but that's the way it was used. So the Holocaust became a tool for keeping us guilty, giving Israel a free pass because of the idea, well, the poor Jews suffered so much, so they should have a country of their own, even though that country is actually somebody else's country. and if you disagree, well, you want to perform another Holocaust. And that's the way it went. So Ernst began to put out this material, and I'm going to have to continue this tomorrow, to put out material, the question, this Holocaust, what he was trying to do was to salvage to regain the honor of the German people. The World War II was not an effort by some psychopath who wanted to exterminate all the Jews in the world or all the Jews in Europe and conquer the world. That was a comic book view of World War II, which was unfair to Germany and unfair to the truth. And that's what Ernst was trying to establish. And part of what he was trying to do involved dealing with this story, this new religion called the Holocaust, and that became his life's work. Not what he intended to do. This is not what he started out to do. He didn't even start out as a politician or a polemicist. He started out and did very well as a graphic artist and also as an artist. I have a number of paintings by Ernst Zundel that he was a good artist as well. Well, I'm coming back to that again tomorrow night, and we'll have a lot more on that, and I hope I may have by that time some commentary by other people who knew Ernst well, and there are many of us who did, especially of the older group. He's a great man. A great man has passed, and we will honor him further. Let's sign off tonight, as always, do with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.